Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPN 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Given an amazing book. It's called Member of the Family, and it's by Diane Lake. Now, and Deborah Herman as a co-writer, and this was unique because we do a lot of talk about Charles Manson and the Manson family, and Diane was part of it, and at age 14, she became one of Charles Manson girls, and now she's written a book and telling us all about what it was like from the inside. So we're welcoming to the show Diane Lake. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Let's talk a little bit about your early life. Now, you grew up in, Minneapolis, I believe?
Yes.
Let's talk about your relationship with your parents. Now, now in the 60s, it seemed like the tune in, turn on, and drop out thing was kind of going on, and your parents decided to do that.
That's correct.
How did that make you feel? I mean, were you good with it? Or?
Well, it seemed like that's the way the world was going. This was, you know, like cutting edge or, you know, this was the new way of thinking, of bringing peace. You know, the Vietnam War was not over, and, you know, there was a lot of protests, and people just were tired of, you know, society the way it was. And so I think that the counterculture movement was, you know, encouraged by Allen Ginsberg, you know, Timothy Leary, Aldous Huxley, and my dad was really into reading all those people and listening to them. So he, even before we got to California, he wanted to go to California because of them. He wanted to be, you know, Jack Kerouac. He wanted to be, you know, go to Berkeley and be part of that scene. He wanted to get his master's degree in art and teach art.
Right. Now, the culture back then, too, for the young listeners that don't know, it's similar in a way of today that there was a lot of distrust for the government and for the cops and all that. You know, like, you know, everybody was kind of separated in that way. So I guess that would have been part of your feeling as well, right? And to be away from that sort of mainstream policing and government.
Right. Now, and I loved school, but my education in Minnesota was a lot better than when I, even back then when I moved to California. My parents, you know, were kind of disillusioned. So that, you know, kind of added to it. And then you start taking LSD and smoking marijuana and listening to Timothy Leary talk about, you know, LSD was wonderful, everybody should take it, you know. And so he got involved with that, and that led to us getting involved with the Oracle, which was an underground newspaper in Los Angeles that was an offshoot of the San Francisco Oracle, and because he wanted to do art for them, and he did do art for them. And that led us to, you know, basically joining that community. And then when they lost their house that they were living in, they moved into ours in Santa Monica. And then that led to, you know, a couple of the guys buying these bakery bread trucks and converting them into campers. And, you know, we were going to go down the road and be a commune, but then it ended up just my family.
Yes, commune living.
Right. So that's what I, you know, and how long we were going to do that, but we basically left the summer that I would have, or in September when I would have been in ninth grade. And I was the oldest of three.
So you guys were just kind of traveling around house to house, or just free as the wind kind of thing? Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah, we were staying at the beaches, you know, the parking lots in the public beaches, you know, on the California coast.
Wow.
Now, quite honestly, how did that feel for you?
It was tight. Five people living in a step-up van. It was a little tight. A little tight, but even though a lot of your living took place outside. I just wanted to help my mom. You know, my mom and dad were arguing, not bad arguments, but, you know, like philosophical kind of arguing about, you know, what the man's role was, what the woman's role was, you know, in this new age, basically. And, you know, I just wanted to help my mom. I was making pancakes one morning and, you know, she criticized me for not flipping them over, you know, at the right time. So I just, you know, I've had it, and I walked off and, you know, found a little boy that needed pushing on the swing, and I did that, and I met his parents, and they were hippies, and introduced him to my parents, and then, you know, we drove the bread truck over to the house that he was, you know, that they were staying at, and, you know, joined up forces and lived with them for a while. And that's where I felt I heard the voice of God on an acid trip say it was time for me to leave home. So I talked to my parents about it. They wrote me a note, and I moved in, you know, basically with that couple, and my parents, you know, went on.
Wow.
We joined up again, and, you know, I went to Big Sur with them. And then I met a guy and went to San Francisco with him, you know, because I had this note in my pocket, you know, basically making me an emancipated minor, although it wasn't legal. You know, it served me. And what 17-year-old doesn't feel like an adult, you know?
Oh, my God. Let me speak to that. You know, I've got a 15-year-old daughter, and she knows everything. I hope she goes to Congress and solves all the world's problems while she still knows everything.
Right?
But the beginning of your story, I mean, almost sounds like a vacation that most kids would love to have.
My friends thought that I died and gone to heaven. I mean, they couldn't believe it. Wow, your parents are doing what? You know, you're not going to have to go to school anymore?
Yes. Until you start meeting these people and your parents turn you over to these people. I mean, that, holy crap. You know, and I'm censoring myself, Diane. Holy crap. I mean, so, what, yeah. Yeah, what maybe, happened there?
Yeah, maybe talk about that. When you first kind of met Charlie in the group and kind of how you kind of got involved with them.
Oh, gosh. I actually met him through another couple. My parents had landed in the hot farm commune when I was in San Francisco. And then I showed up, and I didn't know it, but they had already, Black Bus Charlie, as he was then known, had made a couple of trips up to the hog farm. And he wasn't really welcome there after a few, you know, antics happened. But my mom had ultimately given him my photo and said, she's in San Francisco. If you go to San Francisco, you know, look for her, right? And the girls were from the Midwest. You know, a couple of the girls were from the Midwest, and my mom just thought they were great. And at that point, they were just another commune with, you know, a charismatic leader, Charlie. So anyway, this had transpired, and then when I went to the hog farm, I was considered jail bait. I don't think my parents knew about that conversation, you know, with the head guy.
Well, you were.
I was jail bait, and I, you know, the counterculture really was not the place, and they did not take into consideration the bigger picture of what do you do with a sexually active underage girl. And they're, you know, Timothy Leary, I mean, they're the Oracle, they're all about, you know, sex is good. You know, there was no age. You know, it was like, there might have been, you know, too young, but 14 was not too young to not have sex. I mean, and you know, as I'm sure that, you know, you experienced with your daughter, the hormones are starting to, you know, get woken up. And so there really wasn't a place for a sexually active underage girl, and my parents were just a little bit older. Most of the hippies either in the commune were either young but of age, or they just had little kids. There weren't any other kids my age. I didn't have peers. Yeah. So I didn't feel welcome. I didn't feel welcome at the hog farm. And so when I went to live with this other couple, and they introduced me to Charlie, and when I walked in the door, they already knew me. And I didn't know that. I didn't know this story about my mom giving, you know, him my picture, you know, a month before. So, yeah, she didn't. Anyway, so I walk in the door. The girls run up to me. Charlie, Diane is here. And it's like, what? How do you know me? So then, you know, I got the story that my mom had given them my picture. But nonetheless, I was, you know, and I immediately felt loved and adored. I didn't join them immediately, but 2 weeks later they were getting ready. They were going to go to, on a road trip to New Mexico, and I felt loved and adored by them. And I loved the girls, and I loved Charlie, and he made me feel like really special. And so that's how I ended up becoming a member of the Manson family.
When you were 14 and you were with Charlie and you guys got pulled over, and when they found out you were 14, the cops took you. And just about that. So, I mean, your parents came and got you out of court, but then they just let you go with Charlie again.
Right.
So they knew who you were with, in a way, or they thought it was okay.
Right. Well, he didn't seem any different than, you know, Hugh Romney or, you know, any of these other, you know, pseudo-gurus that were, you know, leading these different communes. They were just these charismatic, you know, leaders. And actually, you know, so he just became this diabolical, you know, person. I don't think murder was on his agenda, you know, even that first year.
Right.
Yeah. It just...
So,
could you mention
turned
that?
Into it.
Yeah, you mentioned about how... it was all kind of love, you know. You guys would sit around, take acid, and sing songs, and it was all about loving each other. When did you see that change, or when did you feel that was becoming different?
About a year and, you know, a month or two in, and we'd already been going to the desert. And he had left me in the desert with another couple to kind of, you know, hold down the fort, you know, so other people, miners or whatever, wouldn't move in, fix it up. I mean, I put white stones, I gathered stones and old wagon wheels and bottles, and, you know, I was decorating the outside. And, but I felt that was the first time that I had really been kind of separated from the inner circle. At least that's how I felt. And so when I had an opportunity, Bobby Beausoleil came up to the desert and wanted to, you know, he basically wanted a girl to help him panhandle, so he must have been broke. So he came up to the desert, you know, maybe hoping to find Charlie, but he didn't. So he asked if I wanted to go with. I did. The whole way, I felt like the rocks and the trees were crying out to me that I had made a mistake. I just felt weird. And when we got to the valley, the family was at Gresham Street, which is, I think it's in Canoga Park, or it doesn't exist anymore. It's apartment buildings now, but there was a whole different vibe going on, and Charlie was very upset with me that I had disobeyed him and not stayed in the desert. So he said, "I'm, you know, you're going back to your parents."
Oh, that Lord.
That's my punishment. You're going back to your parents. You know, well, and lo and behold, he found them.
Well, Diane was... Well, Diane, let's be intellectually honest. Was, at that point, going back to your parents an actual punishment?
Yes. Yes. It shouldn't have been. It shouldn't have been, but it's just, they hadn't really kept in touch. I didn't know where they were. My mom and dad had now separated. My mom had, not officially married, but she was now with another man. And the funny thing is that my dad was still, you know, on the scene. It was a totally mutual thing. You know, they loved each other, but they couldn't live together, one of those situations. And so my parents, her new significant other and my dad are like house parents for an alternative boarding school. And so there's all these kids now my same age. And she's married to this, or, you know, she's got another husband. And I am steeped in Charlieisms and songs. And, you know, my mind is blown on acid. And I got into that, into a house. And I just wanted to climb on the roof and scream out to everybody Charlie songs. And I could not relate to these kids my same age at all. So I wanted to go back. And so I found my way back to where Charlie and company were living. And then he took me to Gary Hinman's. He really did not want me there with them. And that made me feel bad.
Now, psychologically, all of this right now, at this point, is understandable. And how much, because, you know, many of our listeners, and myself included, we have teenage daughters. And, you know, like I was saying at the beginning of the interview, my daughter is 15, you know, and she knows everything. You know, she's lived entire lifetimes. I don't know. You know, I'm stupid today.
And if you turned her loose, if you gave her the choice, you know, she doesn't know about buying her own shampoo and toilet paper and...
Oh, no. I'm stupid till she needs something. But, you know... But how much of this would you actually attribute to teenage rebellion versus the parents just not being connected and attempting to understand their child and willing to just, wow, I mean, it's just, Diane, I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, just releasing you to the wild.
I know, but... The wild back then wasn't as wild as it is now. I mean, a lot of the media has contributed to that, you know, in heightening our awareness of pedophiles and, you know, drugs and all of that. But back in the 60s, you know, we were in a movement where everybody loved and trusted each other, and And I was my parents' oldest, okay, and I take some responsibility for what happened. I was the oldest of three. I walked at 9 months. I wanted to do everything. I wanted to iron, wash the dishes, anything my mom did, I do it. You know, mm-hmm. I do it myself. My nickname was Do Ann.
and that's okay.
Yeah. I was very independent and very capable, very smart, you know, straight-A student, loved school. My mom said I was never happier than when I was going to school. So, and I got a really good education, thankfully, in Minnesota. The 2 years that I was in the California school, it was like, you know, it was kind of a repeat. I had already had a lot of the stuff that I was learning in middle school. So my parents, and then you throw in some drugs and Timothy Leary and, you know, independence of my mom and dad were exploring this new, you know, way of life, and I had asked for emancipation and they'd given it to me. And so, you know, I take some responsibility in that separation. And my mom and dad had both already, you know, disconnected earlier, or even earlier, with a couple of incidents. So I was, you know, mm-hmm. I was on my own. And then my mom said she felt like I was just another sister in the commune. She really didn't, I guess mm-hmm. they didn't think that I needed some direction, supervision, boundaries, advice. Yeah.
Some of the basics.
You know, they bought into the fact that I knew everything.
Yeah. And I'm willing to buy that, you know, but I just can't imagine allowing my 15-year-old daughter to, you know, wander free, you know.
I know.
I sympathize with you. We live in a new time. You know, back when I used to ride my bike through the neighborhood after dark. Now, you know, my daughter better be in bed by 6 right after the Brady Bunch.
You know? that's a little too much.
It is what it is.
When I grew up, I don't know how old you are, I'm 64. But it was like, you know, and my dad didn't even allow us to have a television. But it's like, you know, when you got home from school, look, have some cookies and milk, and then, okay, be home before the streetlights come on, or, you know, when they do come on home, you know, it'll be time for dinner. you know, you could pretty much go anywhere.
Now, how did you get the name Snake?
We were living in Topanga, and I had been fasting. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I had been fasting on, like, lemon honey water. And I just imagined, I wasn't on acid or anything, I just was imagining what it would be like to be a snake slithering through the tall, cool grass. It was probably a hot day, you know, and I would just imagine, I just was imagining what it might be like. And I related that imagining to the girls in the kitchen. They told Charlie, and from then on, that's how I got the name Snake. And there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know, and I kind of know that, but I just thought I'd put it out there for the listeners, so they can kind of find out what the name was really about. And
right, I mean, it was just a very innocent tale. And the interesting thing is, though, that I was born in the year of the snake, according, you know, to the Chinese year.
Oh.
Yeah. Each year, like, I think we're in the year of the rooster right now.
Yeah.
But I was born in the year of the snake, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. Coincidence there. Yeah. And so now you guys got to meet Dennis Wilson and part of the Beach Boys. And what was that experience like?
Dennis was a really fun guy. Cute, you know, he was fun. I got to go to the Colorado River with him and I think two of the other girls in his Rolls Royce. You know, I just had a bathing suit and a cover up on. That's it. And, you know, it was a family vacation or getaway on the Colorado River. So that was kind of interesting. And then, you know, the family wasn't real open and accepting of these kind of ragtag girls that he had. But that's who he was. He was the rebel. He was definitely the rebel in the family. He liked bringing us kind of, you know, ragtag girls to the family party, so to speak. And, you know, he liked to drive fast cars, fast boats. I loved his house. It was Will Rogers' estate on Sunset. Beautiful grounds. I mean, that's what I remember about living there. It was big redwood trees, and there was a big swing hanging, and, you know, from one of the trees, and it was like a big log cabin. Beautiful. Guest house, pool. It was like living in a...
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to boll&branch.com today Exclusions apply. See site for details.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Park.
Yeah.
We made, and I remember we made back then, gosh, what do they call them? Like palazzo pants, you know, like big camel pants or whatever. we made those kind of pants out of his blue satin sheet.
Wow.
That was probably, when I remember, that was probably the worst thing that we did at his house was use his sheets, you know, to make pants for ourselves.
Yeah.
We made garbage runs in his Rolls Royce, and he was really impressed with the food that we could find and prepare. Yeah,
in a Rolls Royce.
Yeah. And we used to go to the back of the grocery store and, you know, look through the dumpsters and load it up and load the trunk up and go home and make them a wonderful meal.
Yeah.
Well, help, Diane. Where were you on grocery day?
You know, do you think he had a lot to do with how Charlie sort of started to change? Because you mentioned about how you know, you guys hung out at the house for so long, but he eventually kind of just moved out himself.
Well, his lease was up. And he didn't own that house. He was just leasing.
And
so he moved in. I think he moved in with Greg Jacobson or Terry Mel. He moved, and so we kind of had to move. And I think that the relationship was starting to sour. His brothers did not like Charlie. They did a recording session with Charlie, and I think they really tried to mold him into like a rock star, and Charlie just was not going to be molded. Do not change the lyrics to his songs. Don't change the way he dresses. So, but I think that in the end, Charlie was disappointed later on because Terry Melcher did like a little recording session with us.
Oh, yeah.
He came and listened to us at the ranch, Charlie playing guitar and, you know, the rest of us, you know, singing along. And we actually went to a studio and did some recording. But at that point, Charlie was not looking to be a rock star, but he would have liked to have made some money because at that point, he really wanted to move to the desert and move us all to the desert. So he was looking for money for supplies, for food, you know, for gas, for more dune buggies, that kind of thing. I don't think Charlie's goal was to be a rock star.
Right. Right.
He didn't want his music changed.
Well,
so he just wanted to make money on his songs.
Now that's portrayed in a lot of shows, you know, because, you know, we all know that he had an obsession with the Beatles. And that is portrayed in a lot of shows. Now, I myself, in preparation for this interview and others, have watched the series Aquarius. How accurate.
I've watched that too.
Yes, well, how accurate is that?
My takeaway on that show it's not really very accurate, but they've got the Charlie-isms, the way Charlie talks in that show, the things that he says are almost creepy. They're so Charlie-like. So where whoever is helping them, whoever they're consulting with, or maybe they just picked that up from different, you know, YouTube videos or whatever, but it's amazing how accurate the Charlie-isms, what Charlie speaks, what, you know, the some of the things that he says, but the rest of it is just, it's BS.
Minutia. Okay, let's go to the Charlie-isms. When you first met him, because that's what amazed me about the show, is when he first meets people, the way he's able to enrapture them. What was it about him when you first met him that really captured you?
Well, he has this uncanny ability to read people, to, you know, find out what their needs. I mean, it's just like he can, like, see through you and know what your needs, your deep needs, your heart, you know, your heartfelt desires are, and then he can be that or provide that. I don't think he has true empathy. I think he just read people, but then he uses it for his own benefit.
You know, people like him do have the ability to read people, and they can approach you where you're at. But he found a weakness in you and was able to manipulate you through that weakness. For example, if you don't do what I want you to do, then I'm going to turn you back over to your parents. Was that really such a penalty that you were willing to do whatever Charlie Manson, as we know him today, wanted?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think he knew that I didn't want to be with my parents, and he was treating me, I think, even more important is that he was treating me like a child. And that I did not want to be treated like a child.
Right.
I was an adult. I was an emancipated minor.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, he gave you a sense of freedom. I'm going to, you know, even though you're 14, I will treat you like an adult. You can, you know, you can have sex, you can have drugs, you can have anything as long as you follow these guidelines. If you don't do what I ask, then I'm going to send you back to this, you know, parental authority. You're going to go back into the system. And is that
right,
kind of what kept you there?
Yeah. I think it's just because he made me feel, you know, loved and adored most of the time. Or when I was on a Dr. Phil show, Dr. Phil said that he used this term that I hadn't heard before, but it's called love bashing. And it's a manipulation where they just shower you with love and affection and adoration to get you under their power. And then they mistreat you later on, but you still remember that, you know, the original good feelings. And I think that's really how Charlie kept me, was because whether it was a manipulation or it was just a natural exchange, that, you know, I really don't know. But I did, that was my greatest weakness, even facing him in court, was I going to succumb to those original feelings of being loved and adored by him.
Now, how did it feel while you were in court?
Yeah, were you worried about some sort of follow back? by somebody for being in court against him?
Not really, because at that point I was living with Inyo County Sheriff. Took me in as his foster child. So, you know, I had protection. They lived in a very tiny little town, you know, and not even that Bishop was the closest town. So, you know, which is the biggest town from Mammoth. So I felt safe. I did. And then after when I turned 18, I went to junior college. And after a semester there, then I went to, or two semesters, I went to Spokane. And then I went to, then I lived in Europe for 2 years. And so I was really, I wasn't worried about that at all.
You were pretty close with the other girls in the family. How did it make you feel then? Didn't you? I mean, it must have been pretty traumatic because you didn't know about what was going on with the killings.
No.
So this must have been, to find out these people you're really close with were involved in this, like, that must have been the hardest part of it.
Yeah. It was. I mean, I was just shocked that these women, you know, that I had loved, you know, emotionally and, you know, in some cases physically, you know, were capable of this mayhem. You know, it was shocking, and I, it just totally discombobulated me, you know, for the rest of the time that I was in the desert. And why I hid, you know, from the police the first time, you know, that it was raided, you know, behooves me. But that I was thinking the whole time I was hiding under that bush all day, you know, was that Charlie was going to be so proud of me, you know, so I'm still seeking. I'm still seeking his approval, even though he's, you know, he has, you know, threatened to hang me upside down and skin me alive. And, you know, I know that he told Tex, you know, to go, you know, kill these people and, you know, or whoever was in the house. And it was just like, oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, when I think back on it, it was just craziness. And that's why I'm so happy that I had an opportunity to write this book and really, you know, dig down. My collaborator was awesome in helping me dig down. Plus, you know, my husband of 35 years had died, and so I was in counseling for grief. And it just was really helpful to kind of unearth the depths of what had happened to me. Because it wasn't until I wrote the book, or, you know, contributed writing the book, that I even felt really like I had been a victim.
Right.
You know, I had taken a lot of responsibility for what happened to me, you know, because of my independence and all of that. But really, you know, I mean, my daughter is in her 30s now, but she was a teenager, and I just thought, oh, my, you know, they're not ready, no matter how much they think they are.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> Yeah, well, that's how we always see it later, right? But at the time.
Yeah, and I'm a, you know, I've got a bachelor's and a master's degree now in like human development, and, you know, because I was a teacher. And the human brain really isn't fully matured until you're like around 21, and I didn't even feel like I became an adult until I was like in my 50s.
Yeah.
You know, one day I woke up like,
no, I'm there with you. I'm there with you.
Yeah, it's something.
So, you know, life is funny, but I really appreciated, you know, having the opportunity to write this book and being brave enough, you know, to to do it, because I think it's an amazing story that I made it through, have the intelligence, and I hope that this gives hope for parents who have kids that have gone off the deep end. You know, they can make it through. You know, they can come back. You know, they can make it, because I was crazy. From taking too many drugs, you know, and not having, you know, the supervision and the, you know.
No,
and all of that.
An important point too is, like, now you never took, you weren't involved in any of these murders, and that, and he kept he kept you kind of distant from it. Do you know why he did that, or was there a particular reason? Was it your age, or do you have any idea?
I don't think I was reliable.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good thing.
I was too independent, you know. I mean, and I disobeyed him. I didn't, you know. I came back from the desert, you know. He told me to stay there, and I didn't. So I don't think I was very trustworthy. Plus, I don't think I could have done that.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you think would have handled it if he did ask you to come along? And I mean, that would have been, wouldn't you? That would have been a terrible amount of pressure to put on you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I could have done it. You know, so would they have killed me because I can? You know, I don't know. Mm. I mean, I just. Thank you, Lord, that I never had to experience that.
I also noticed, you know, what stuck out was when you were talking about when he was playing the White Album a lot, like your groups would get together, and instead of loving and singing and doing acid, all of a sudden it was all about the White Album and how it was speaking to him, and the Beatles were looking for him, and all that stuff. And that one time when you had to go to the bathroom, you had to go pee, and he made you do it in front of everybody.
Yep.
And I thought, wow. But you still stuck with it. Like, it didn't make you leave.
I know, you know, yeah, it was embarrassing and it was humiliating, but, I think he'd embarrassed and humiliated me, you know, enough before that was just, you know, but it stuck with me. He was using me as an example. He didn't like it if I diverted my attention. Like, if he had the group's attention, you know, we're all sitting around the circle listening to him, you know, talk about whatever, you know, was on his mind that he thought was important to impart, you know, and if I would make a flip comment, or, which I'm prone to do, and I still am. So I know that was part of my personality, that he didn't like that. And so there were times when, you know, I felt like he did discipline me, embarrass me, or, you know, smack me or whatever, you know, as an example. You know, that I better pay attention. And when we were in the desert, I was very distracted when I had found out about the murders and the people's participation in it, and how gruesome, you know, and just callous they were about it, that I had a hard time staying focused. And that's when he threatened to, you know, hang me upside down, skin me alive. And at that point, I had no reason not to believe that he would.
When the authorities, the police, when they got involved, how did you feel about that?
Well, I didn't tell them how old I was or my real name for a couple of months. We were all in the jail together. The girls were all in the jail together in the same cell. And, you know, admonishing one another not to say anything. And it wasn't until Susan Atkins started telling her cellmate in Los Angeles about Charlie and Helter Skelter and, you know, how you know, her participation in those murders, and her cellmate then told them. So they hauled us all down from Inyo County to Los Angeles County to testify in front of the grand jury. They were looking for indictments. And it, after not taking drugs, having good food, reading, and overhearing a couple of matrons, you know, say those poor girls are never going to make it, it wasn't, I had all that as a foundation, and it wasn't until I was standing in front of the bailiff, ready to go in to the grand jury, that they asked me name, you know, age, all that, and I told them, I'm Diane Lake, I'm 16, and I want my mommy. <You know? laughs> So, 'cause I'm in a women's jail, I'm 16. They immediately separated me from the rest of the group. But that was the first time that I had felt safe enough to even say my name, to tell them my real name and my real age. Because up until then, I had been arrested in Ventura County with a fake ID. And so I was using that. Even though they took the fake ID from me, you know, they actually had to call back in the days, you know, before digital media and, you know, communication, they actually had to call and say, oh, did you have, you know, a Diane Bluestein age such and such? You know, yeah, they did. And so that's all. They didn't go into the details. Oh, yeah, but it was a fake ID, and, you know, maybe the operator didn't have that information. I don't know. But so that's who they thought I was. And now they know I'm underage. And so now their tactic, now they're not threatening the gas chamber. I mean, when they thought I was an adult, you know, I'm getting interrogated for, you know, a couple of hours and being threatened. We know you, who you are, honey, and, you know, and you're going to the gas chamber, you know, and, blah, you know, all that, those kind of tactics. But then when I told them how old I was and they separated me and then I had all these detectives and policemen and who knows who coming and talk to me, they were much nicer and kinder, brought me candy.
Oh, that's sweet.
And, you know, but so they softened me up, you know, and then I quickly became a ward of the court and went to, you know, a mental hospital, and that was a wonderful experience. And I, you know, I no longer have stigma about that. You know, before, you know, who wants to tell anybody
to be
in a mental hospital? But yeah. It was a good experience. I learned how to play the flute. I learned how to crochet. I had all these moms. I had all this nurturing. I had good food. You know, I had psychiatric and psychological counseling, and they really were able to, you know, deprogram.
Yeah.
And then my arresting officer takes me in as a foster child, and so I, you know, they really saved my life.
If you were to face Charlie Manson today, how would that interaction, how would that go?
And then if I saw Charlie, I mean, Charlie, actually, I can't just go visit him. I have to submit paperwork, and then he would have to approve my coming to visit him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's how the system works now. Well, so I can't just go say, oh, I want to go visit him and say hi, you know, or whatever. But if I did have an opportunity to visit him and I had one question, I would ask him, did he really believe he was Jesus Christ at one point? Because I think that was really the pivotal for him and pivotal for us, that we believed that he was, you know, some kind of Messiah, you know, and he would reiterate it all the time that his name, Man's Son, you know, was no accident, that he was, you know, God's son, man's son. And so I think that's why, you know, he bought the White Album, you know, the Beatles were talking to him, you know, sending him a message because, you know, because he was, you know, the Messiah, the coming, the second coming kind of guy.
Now, how do you feel about him now, honestly?
crazy. He just, yeah, he's crazy.
Yeah. Just simple.
Crazy. It's that
easy. Yeah, I can say he's a psychopath or, you know, but he's just crazy, you know, and he loves it that way.
Yeah.
You know? He likes being, I'm sure that he loves being the icon of evil. I'm sure, it's exciting to him.
How did people receive you now? Are you worried about negative feedback now that you're kind of coming out and talking?
I'm worried about what I call the wackadoodles. I'm worried about the people that are obsessed with this case and that they think they know everything there is about it. And those are actually the only, negative reviews. I mean, my book has been very well received. The people in my community, my church, the people I've known for, 30-plus years, they're just in awe. Oh, we thought you were the church lady, or we thought you were the choir lady. You know, that they are amazed, and most people are just thrilled, that I'm telling my story, because it gives so much hope. I mean, there's so many, my story can reach a lot of different people on a lot of different levels, and to give them hope, and I like being a bright light in this whole Manson murder thing, because it's so dark, and most of the people didn't make it out.
Right.
And live to tell the tale. So, I'm happy that I have this opportunity to bring some light and some hope and some recovery and some redemption and some of God's grace to the story.
The book is called Member of the Family. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Diane, thank you. Thank you so much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.